Good evening, everybody. Good evening. There's a lovely buzz of conversation as each of you talks to his or her neighbors, but let me call your attention to the program as a whole and the collective conversation for the evening. Welcome to the third of the series of five Urban Age Global Debates. These debates celebrate 10 years of the Urban Age. The Urban Age is an extraordinary LSE-based program, but really a global program that knits our work together with cities around the world and their future. The Urban Age also doubles as the LSE Department of Graphic Design. And tonight, you are presented with one of its examples suitable for framing, or at least for sticking above the toilet in your home. The Urban Age program has had an illustrious history in a series of extraordinary events. But the events, the convocations, the congresses, the conferences that bring together the Urban Age are only part of the story, because each of them is based on extensive research, networking, bringing together urban planners, people in public life, architects, social scientists doing research on cities, activists campaigning on a range of different urban issues in a series of the world's most important cities. And when I say most important cities, it's a set of cities that include some very large cities, but also very innovative cities, cities that are taking on challenges of dealing with a variety of different problems. And over its 10 years of existence, the Urban Age has produced a cumulative growth in the network of people, because people from one city, Chicago, want to go to the next conference in Delhi or wherever, but also of knowledge, as it builds on of the research base of the social sciences and couples it with knowledge of actual agendas of urban action in these different cities. Throughout, this program has been supported by the Alfred Herrhausen Society, which is itself funded by Deutsche Bank. It's been supported generously and wisely, I would like to stress. And I say that in front of Tomas Matusek and Uta Wieland, who were key leaders of the Alfred Herrhausen Society. Unfortunately, the new chair, Paul Achtleitner, can't be with us tonight, but we are very grateful for the continued support of Deutsche Bank and the Alfred Herrhausen Society. They have been not only financial supporters, but actively involved in LSE Cities, the base unit at LSE that supports the Urban Age, and in the Urban Age itself. For LSE, the Urban Age has represented an important academic innovation, but also an important public innovation, a kind of bridge between the LSE and outside constituencies in the range of cities studied. It has been an innovation, and it's also been an exploration, which has extended the LSE's impact and reach to policymakers, urbanists, academics, and many more across the world. The Urban Age program is profoundly interdisciplinary, and through this, it connects closely to LSE's core values of bringing social science knowledge together with the problems, challenges of the world around us. Tonight, we tackle the fundamental question of who owns the city. Previous global debates have tackled climate change and the limits of planning. Tomorrow, we will hear from Norman Foster on infrastructure, and we will end on the 3rd of December with Richard Sennett discussing questions of social equity in the city. But tonight, to discuss the issue of new patterns of ownership and their impact on the city, we have three speakers, all closely connected with the Urban Age. Saskia Sassen. Saskia is well known at the LSE from her time as a centennial professor here, perhaps even better known to many of you through her many writings. She's a professor at Columbia University, the author of a number of important books, including most recently, and in sadly, typically, great timing, her book Expulsions, Brutality and Complexity in the Global Economy was published last year. Second panelist with us is Tony Williams. Tony Williams is the former mayor of Washington, D.C., currently the CEO and chief executive officer of the Federal City Council of Washington, D.C., and also a leading expert on public finance and cities, and a leading figure in urban leadership beyond Washington as a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School and as a coordinator of programs at the Ash Center. The third panelist is Jose Castillo, a practicing architect in Mexico City, but also a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Design, and has co-founded a leading practice in architecture that has done award-winning work in areas from social housing to cultural facilities, infrastructure, and large-scale master plans. So we have three extraordinary speakers, each of them individually significant, but also each of them able to bring a key different perspective to a collective conversation. I think I've accidentally started Saskia's presentation for us. We'll go back. First, however, before we start, I wish to read a message that we've just received. We had invited a fourth speaker to be with us, Jean-Louis Misaka, the deputy mayor of Paris. Not surprisingly, in the sad current circumstances, Deputy Mayor Misaka cannot be with us, but has sent this message. Attacks in Paris on November 13th left 130 people dead and scores wounded. Terrorism is the enemy of humanity. The neighborhoods where all generations cohabit, all languages are spoken, and all cultures mingled were affected. But hatred does not reach us. We choose to live and vibrate, to talk and to listen, exchange and share. We won't give up our art of passionately living in peace. In this painful period, the motto of Paris, Fluctuat net mergitur, makes sense and becomes a resistance slogan for all Parisians. What terrorists wanted to kill is our freedom. The air we breathe, the language we speak, the blood that beats in our veins. Paris will never accept slavery. We remain ourselves committed to freedom, equality, and fraternity, and fiercely attached to our singularity in the world, as much as our openness to the world. Thoughts and sympathy from London to Paris were met with kindness, especially as we know you have experienced the same kind of terrible events in the past. On behalf of Parisians, I would like to thank all the people of London for their expression of solidarity. It meant a lot, and it warmed our hearts. I regret not being able to join you tonight, and I wish you passionate and constructive discussions. Jean-Louis Misaka. Now, we begin with words from Saskia Sassen.
Well, it's an enormous pleasure and really a big, big pleasure that we are celebrating 10 years of Urban Age. So I really want to thank Ricky Burdett, the London School of Economics across years that have all supported this fantastic project. It is really sui generis. I don't know of anything like it. But now I'm going to start with my lecture. I'm going to show you a few negative aspects of cities today. And so to frame that, I want to start with what I think of cities. What is it about cities that matters so much today? So a first feature is that cities are really complex but incomplete systems. And given that mix, they have managed to outlive all kinds of more powerful actors, which, however, are formal and closed, maybe complex, but closed. Think of most corporations that have ever been invented. They're gone. But the cities where they were, they're still here. When you look at cities that way, then you must say, okay, here is a particular kind of systematicity that actually is very interesting, that contains capabilities. A second feature is that I think of the city as a space where those without power get to make a history, a culture, an economy, a neighborhood economy. In other words, a space where powerlessness can become complex. They don't necessarily become empowered, but their powerlessness can become complex. And in that sense, they can make. It's a space where they can make. And then finally, I think of the city as a sort of frontier zone. When I ask myself, where is today's frontier? I think it's in cities. It might also be in a few places where you have, you know, massive mining expansion and land grabs and you have encounters with indigenous people. But it's not like the frontier as we knew it, you know, in our imperial epoch. And the frontier, one definition of the frontier space is that it is a space where actors from different worlds have an encounter for which there are no established rules of engagement. Now, in the past, that meant very often that we just slaughtered them or we took whatever they had. But today, in the city, it's a highly intermediated encounter. And so the city is also a space where power, which has increasingly become very abstract, very intermediated, actually hits the ground one moment in its trajectory, in its often global trajectory. And it becomes men and women who want it all and get it all and thereby leave a huge footprint. They make power, which is today, I repeat, so intermediated and elusive, they actually give it a very concrete moment. And having grown up in Argentina, the sort of the fighting poor have this wonderful phrase, estamos presentes. We're present. We're not asking you for anything, power. We are here. That's all. So the city enables those without power to have that position, to sort of say, you know what? The city is also mine. And those three features, I mean, one could list a few more, but let me just stick with those three. They mark for me a possibility, a set of capabilities, you know, a lot of positives. So what I turn to next is some of the main features that are happening in some of our major cities. I'm actually working with a data set of 100 cities, and these 100 cities are classified in terms of they're the leading 100 cities in terms of foreign investment. So I'm not going to show you the full 100 cities because it just would be a list that goes all over. So I'll just show you a few. And so the main issue here really is a kind of buying of urban land that I think represents a major threat to those particular features of cities that have enabled cities to have long lives and that have enabled those without power to actually feel that this is also my city. So those are sort of the critical concerns within which I want to situate a lot of the data that I'm showing you, all right? So there is a broader framing here. So if this is just a few, but very quickly, I don't want to dwell too much, there isn't a lot of time. So these are the top 10, this is total foreign and national investment. This is a story that begins in 2008. I mean, it had older versions, but really what I'm talking about, right, it's a whole new phase. Begins in 2008, the crises, etc. And so this is just 1 year, mid-2013 to mid-2014. In that year, the top 100 cities received $600 billion just buying property. It does not include site development. You know, when you buy a big piece of land and you totally redevelop it. So it's just buying property. Now, you can see that New York Metro is number one. New York likes very much always to be number one. London is number two, far more modest, not, you know. Tokyo, and you see a mix. Now, if I showed you the 100, it's an extraordinary mix of cities. So it includes also, I am Dutch, and so Amsterdam, you know, and they're in shock at what's happening there. Now, I'll develop a bit more, you know, what are the contents, etc., of all of this. Now, here is another way of looking at it. You know, you have sort of a more dramatic feature. Again, and I think the list is just a bit longer here. I don't know if you can see in the back what we're talking about, but, you know, just looking at the ones that are further down, you have Shanghai, Seattle, Miami, Beijing, Stockholm, Melbourne, Denver, Philadelphia, etc., Toronto. So it is a mix of cities. And there are quite a few American cities, and I think that is probably a function of the data gathering bit, you know, that they are better documented. Now, if you only take foreign, London is number one, and a very high proportion of investment in London is foreign. And I think you all know the story, so I like to say about this, you know, many people think that, oh my God, this is gentrification. On steroids, maybe, but still. Well, I'm not so sure. So this little, it's a vignette, but it is actually a truth. The Qatari royals own more of London than the Queen of England. Pache, the Queen of England, is not the main owner of London. But, you know, and I don't worry about either, by the way. They're totally fine. But, you know, when that happens, then if you just say, ah, this is gentrification, it's a sort of invitation not to think. Not to understand, well, what am I actually witnessing here? What is happening? Now, again, here you have a longer list. And here, you know, if you go further down, you see Frankfurt, Seoul, Hong Kong, Barcelona. A lot of cities, including sort of mid-sized cities, are part of this story. Now, boy, when I wrote them on my computer, these letters, they look very tiny. Here it's like, wow, I didn't mean it. So, oof, it's beautiful, but very dramatic. White and black always works. So what does it all mean? Now, what does it all look like? Or look like, right. So this is one example. Look what good taste. These are all Chinese acquisitions. Nothing against the Chinese, yeah, because there are many nationalities. But look at what they all bought. I don't know if people can see it from the back, but it's quite a select bit of buildings. So one has to stand back and say, good taste. Now, what else is involved? You know, that's another story. This is also a Chinese company, not such good taste. This is New York. This is a site in New York called Atlantic Yards, which actually has a mix, you know, it's sort of an underutilized, it's a huge piece of land, and it has, you know, little factories, but, you know, little fabricators who actually feed into the architectural profession, etc. It has artist studios. It has a lot of activities that were displaced from Lower Manhattan, because Lower Manhattan is, you know, totally built up now. And so it is actually very nice. It's deeply urban, even though it is low density. Now, at the same time, this Chinese company, which bought it, this is site development, this is not property, is going to erase all of that and build. The last thing I heard was 14 massive towers, luxury towers for residents. Now, that adds to the density, but I argue it actually deurbanizes. Because it creates one use. It privatizes a lot of land. It eliminates little urban tissue, little streets, et cetera, et cetera. The architecture, what shall I say? It's impressive, isn't it? I mean, it's like your own little colossus. I also adore Atlantic Yard. It's just not an elegant name, so they called it something like Pacific Yards. You know, there is a Pacific also on the other side of the country. But, no, evidently there is an old street in Brooklyn. Maybe Brooklyn always had aspirations that has something of the Pacific in it. I think it's an avenue. So Now, very quickly, just to one way of wrapping up, the top 100 cities, I've only shown you a few, and this goes by property investment, just buying property, not the site development I just showed. They account for 10% of the world's population, 30% of the world's GDP, and 76% of property investment. You have to say, wow. Je me lève le chapeau. Very disturbing, people. That is what I'm really meaning. So one of the effects when you have that kind of, you know, I don't know, manipulation of land, etc., is sort of the possibility of inventing whole new housing markets. And this is information I have from the Financial Times, did a very, very good study on this. So this is the so-called super prime housing market. And these are minimum prices. By now, actually, the de facto minimum price is like 100 million. Now, this is housing. What I've shown you today, except for Atlantic Yards, was mostly office buildings, etc. Now, these are the main nationalities. This tells, each of these cities actually tells a tale about who are the main buyers. So if you look at Dubai, it's quite different. You know, you can see Dubai is situated in a sort of a geography that makes it quite different from London or from Monaco, etc. I love this one, Shanghai. It looks like the world wants to buy a flat in Shanghai. Look at that, that's quite a mix. And Hong Kong, who wants to buy in Hong Kong? The main buyers are mainland Chinese. I find this very comic, but people mostly don't find it very comic. You realize, I mean, everybody, it's like it's a beauty. Anyhow, much to be said about each one of these. Now, as we know from London, London here is a very powerful exhibit of what's happening. So London has a lot of these properties that you know, and New York has that a bit too, are not occupied. There are now people who make it a sport in Manhattan to go stand where these new towers are, and at night, all windows are dark, or maybe one is lit. We know some people have bought in and are actually living in there, oh my God, and they say, we feel very lonely here, and they're about to check out. So this is really about buying into a city. And so in my bigger study, I'm beginning to think of, this is about buying urban land. Not just this, but I mean everything that I've been showing to you. And so the issue here also is, you know, what are the legal regimes that we have, and they vary enormously by city, that actually govern land, urban land ownership? There's a lot of ambiguity. And one of the thoughts when I think of the big property contracts that I mentioned before is to what extent the contracts are going to be shaping the elements of an emergent urban law, where there is not much urban law governing the notion of who owns urban land as opposed to the buildings. See, the UK has in parts of itself a very clear regime, like you may own the top, but you don't own the land, actually, right? But in many cities, that is not the case. So I'm doing for Habitat a little study where I'm looking at five cities in the world, including, say, like Mumbai, Joburg, that have very different ways of understanding who owns urban land. I'm also working with a lawyer, a legal scholar, who is obsessed here in London about this question, who owns the land in London? Not the buildings, but the land. So there is a duke who owns most of it, or a lot of it, but then there are all kinds of other. So anyhow, to me, this is an issue that enters into the picture here. Now, these are images taken by a photographer. The name is there, I think, of The Guardian, who managed to get into some of these mansions. And you can see nobody has lived there quite a while. I would say it takes quite a bit of time. This is another property, to get that much moss on a staircase, right? So this is really about occupying. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I don't know where this all goes. But you know what? For now, I'm going to grab it. It is a kind of land grab. It's not just about building new buildings. I think there are multiple logics that come together here. Now, another parallel history. is the issue of foreclosures. Foreclosure is a notice. But according to the Fed, I mean, this is now about the United States. According to the Fed, our central bank, when Bernanke stepped down, the former head of the Fed, he said over 14 million households have lost their homes. This is data that comes from the Federal Reserve. You know, the central banks are research institutions, besides all the other things that they do. You know, these are annual numbers. So these 14 million, this is about a total of 14 million, and most of them, according to the Fed, are out of their homes, either now already or very soon. And in my book Expulsions, I sort of examine this issue in some detail, and I say, you know, what does it mean to have foreclosures on 14 million households? Well, that's about 30 million people. So my country, the Netherlands, has about 16 million people. So I'm trying to make it Pythagorean. 30 million is a big number. So it is like some voice from above says, from above the Netherlands says, okay, everybody on the territory of the Netherlands, out. Where you go, I don't know, but out. And now we repeat the exercise. That is 30 million people. And I'm very intrigued always by how the very material, because 30 million bodies, that's a lot of materiality, huh? Materiality is used in a bit of an abstract sense, that we cannot see that. This is an imaginary geography that I'm telling you about. We can imagine 30 million people, but we actually don't see it. Huh? So it's sort of an interesting dimension. Oh my God, is that the little cough that means that I have to start wrapping up? Yes?
Oh no. Okay, here we go. Anyhow, so very bad stuff. And
Europe thinks it doesn't have this problem. It does. And I can't help but feel, I won't say glee, because there is a lot of suffering here, but also Germany, which has an economy that we really admire, you know, deservedly so, and the United Kingdom. Now, these are households, remember? The worst case in Europe right now is Hungary and Latvia. So Hungary has 1 million households. The data actually go on for other years. So this is a particular kind of financial instrument. I cannot develop that. But it is an insidious way of winding up, that's not the intention, huh, of the instrument, with a lot of empty urban space. Now, I am not trying to, this is not a conspiratorial thing that I'm saying. I'm just juxtaposing elements. And how can I not, instead of just talking about investments and buying, also talk about these kinds of features? Now, oh my God, this is my last slide, more or less. I'm so impressed. So why does all of this matter? I am still engaging with the big letters here. Well, it matters. I'm just going to invoke what I said at the beginning for all the reasons that I mentioned at the beginning, the kind of space that a city is. This kind of massive construction adds a lot of density, but actually de-urbanizes. And it sort of makes you also understand that density by itself is not enough. An office park can be very dense. Those without power can go and have a job there. But when they're done, they have to leave. They cannot, it's not like going back to their communities and having also partly a life of their own. Now the final element that I, and this is the final image, is that one of the capabilities of urban space is to generate an urban subject. An urban subject that can transcend the religious subject, the ethnic subject, the racial subject, etc. Now, the urban subject is a momentary condition, so I leave you with this last slide. This is one sort of moment of the day, rush hour, when we all become urban subjects. Thank you very much.
Here, you sit next to Saskia. Sure. It is required that you have an argument, but that you be close to each other at this point in the conversation. So Saskia, thank you very much for really stimulating, slightly disturbing, but very stimulating, picture of the issue of ownership in the city. We now have time for a discussion with our two really exceptional panelists who have been encouraged to end the LSE tradition, ask hard questions, and then we'll open it up for questions to the floor. So let me go first to Tony Williams, if I can, and ask you to think about this. Saskia has given us a picture of not just the common picture of inequality, but of a real erosion of some of the nature of the city with a transformation of ownership and potentially of both private and public space. What is your view of what's going on here?
You know, the common view in the cities I've seen, both in the urban age and my work in the United States, is that when you visit a city for one of our discussions or you're an investor coming to invest in the city or live in the city, it's like the people who are in the outer classes, if you will, the kind of denigrated people, the other people are like the crazy uncle that's always kind of kept in the back room. So we're going to show you the city we want you to see, which is what Saskia would call the global city, the formal city. And we don't want you to see the informal city in all these people. We saw this in all this. We saw this in Sao Paulo. We saw this in Mumbai. We saw this in Istanbul. We saw it over. You see it in my city, Washington, D.C. And a lot of, managing this as a mayor is on the underground here, you say mind the gap. It's when you're, the mayor, you're minding all these kind of breaches and all these gaps. And one between the quote-unquote underclass or the real people of the city and all these new people in the city. I take this bus to work. It's called the X2 bus. And it goes from the poorest part of the city to the most prosperous part of the city. Now, the Washington Post does a story about the X2. And they made this X2 look like a ride to hell. You would not want to be in this bus. It's a horrible bus. There's this crime, plundering and pillaging on the bus, except I take this bus all the time to work. This is not the bus I know, right? The bus I know would be more like the Canterbury Tales, right? There's like the clown and there, all the jesters and all the people entertaining. But on this bus, which is what I've seen in all these cities where we've been, people in the most dire circumstances, you go into their home, and their home is tidy. People under the most intensive pressure, these mothers on the bus, they've got their two or three kids, they probably got how many jobs, taking their kids to work at 6:37 in the morning. These are the people that really power the city, that as a mayor, it's ultimately your job to represent, to address, to embrace. And we've got to figure out a way to do that, because right now, and I'll wrap up with this, right now the common thinking in many countries, and certainly in the United States, is that, and I've been part of this whole, I won't say, but I have to be careful here because a lot, I work with a lot of these guys.
careful.
The idea was that 20 years ago, the city was about pathology, and it was about bad circumstances, and it was about all these ills. Now, to bring in new investment to the city has to be about exporting. It has to be about creating new markets. We're not going to talk anymore about the pathology of the city and all the dire circumstances of the city. We're going to talk about the new city. And we're not going to talk about the need for national policy to address enormous circumstances of inequality. We're not going to talk about that. We're going to work without national governments. We're not going to talk about the need for the corporate sector to take additional responsibility, even though in a global economy, the big question for a global economy is, if you're a global corporation, where is your city home? This is not always clear anymore. We're going to do this all on our own, and it's a big,
inversion.
Big problem.
Inversion.
It's an inversion. I mean, it's a big, big problem.
Right.
So I'm tempted, I'm going to resist the temptation to follow up with Tony, who's been at every single Urban Age conference, and ask whether mayors really have capacity to deal with this. Are they put on the spot, and how much they have mayors, so how much real capacity they have to deal with this? But first, I want to ask Jose on this, coming from the perspective of an architect and thinking about this same sort of pattern. What does this do to the design issues for urban space?
I would say the first thing we have to address is what do we talk about when we talk about design, and what do we talk about when we talk about planning. It seemed that even from Monday's presentations by Alejandro Aravena and Joan Clos, the discussion of how we frame our understanding of planning is key to the notion of how we decide to act vis-a-vis some of these issues. I would think that the first notion of design is to actually give something a name. Design, which comes from diseño and Latin designo, to name things, is actually, in a way, what Saskia is doing here. Mm-hmm. She's naming something. I don't know if she knows what to do about that something.
It's slightly monstrous in my sense.
It's maybe
ungraspable. Monstrous, and the city that you describe is precisely this. Is the poor have given us cosmopolitanism. You know, we have taken it all from all these different cultures, and then it gets sort of, you know, it becomes something else, unrecognizable as coming from there. Yeah. But without all of those diverse, so I think that this what is happening
like
right now
food served
is
in a fancy
monstrous
restaurant.
Development. Yeah. A monster. I really want to use the term monster. So we could also say it's aggressive, it's bad capitalism, it's whatever. But I want to also say that vis-a-vis the city, it is a kind of monstrous intervention.
Let me ask you two things which have to do
of course,
with
you,
the notion.
Maybe you built some of those buildings.
I wish.
Do you really wish?
No, I mean,
no,
I think there's a kind of power, yes. Powerfulness to the notion of being an architect. It comes with a narcissism is the middle name. So,
right. Yes.
I do think that the question is, Alejandro Aravena was talking about this on Monday. So how do we reclaim a notion of power
in the
question of a kind of reflexive self-criticism of what has become of our cities and what has become of our discipline? I wanted to show, or well, maybe visualize two examples in Mexico City that have to do with these two approaches to design. One of them is the gated community called Bosques de Santa Fe, which 10 years ago we visited before the waste dump, Ute. And it's probably one of the most dramatic cases of urban exclusion. Geography becomes a way of exclusion. To access this community for 200 families, you cross a tunnel from one ravine to another.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks ago, the hill next to this tunnel, there was a big landslide. So literally the tunnel was blocked, limiting the connection of this community to the outer world of Santa Fe.
And suddenly it was a crisis?
It became like a huge crisis. Even the mayor is taking this issue into its own hands. Right. So we kind of are tempted to see this as a kind of nature taking vengeance on the extreme forms of capitalism.
Yes.
And that's an easy task to criticize, those forms of exclusion. I'm more concerned about the ways that the subtler forms of exclusion do happen. And the other side of the coin is actually one of the most successful public space reclaiming projects in Mexico City Center, which is a pedestrianization of Madero in the historic center. Some of you may know the street.
Of course, we walked there. I mean,
think of something between Exhibition Road and, Covent Garden. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that what we tend to see as a success story in terms of reclaiming public space, underneath the surface, is similar to what you're talking about. Not a land grab, but certainly a huge accumulation of leases by a very limited number of properties. So Inditex holds maybe 45%. So Inditex, which is Zara and Massimo Dutti and all those companies, they hold a large percentage of the retail. They're closing basically what used to be the access to the upper floors, and Madero has become a de facto a shopping mall. It is an open shopping mall, but the question of how do we regulate, which is a challenge, but at the same time, how do we learn from the mistakes of designing or maybe not designing well enough how that transformation is going to happen is really at the key of the problem.
I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. And it seems to me that when I take a bit of a more abstract perspective and I use other language to describe these land grabs or whatever, this buying of property and just letting it sit there very often, I think that, in my view, a lot of this sort of this second capitalist phase that we have had that really begins after the crisis, I mean, it begins in the 1980s, generates economies of extraction. When you think about finance, which is radically different from traditional banking, the traditional bank sells something it has, money, at an interest. Finance sells something it does not have. And therein lies its danger, because it has to invent complex instruments to invade and take. And it invades to extract. So we think of finance as this complex set of transactions. No. It is also, it does that, but it does that often with a logic that is a logic of extraction. These investments that I described, I think they're just to some extent holding their money there because, you know, there are other issues. But this is a kind of also an economy of extraction. And there, and that I find that this, when you begin to look at a lot of our dominant sectors as having this logic of extraction inside of them, then you see the radical difference with capitalism one. By the way, I've never really liked capitalism that much, but capitalism one was a bit recent. I mean the post-war decade. It's not really literally number one. Number one started...
So if we're going to have capitalism, we ought to have the post-war boom.
Well, I was going to say it a bit differently because that is not, you know, it's not like one can choose that as an option.
I think the problem is that when you're mayor, though, you have to deal with capitalism. You can't choose your form
exactly.
of government.
So this
but
is why
mass,
I wanted to...
Can I just, I have to finish the point, though. Rather than extraction, mass consumption, which means that every household's individual consumption actually mattered. Mass consumption had the capacity to make new orderings. Today, it still exists, but it doesn't have the capacity to make new orderings. Finance makes new orderings, you know, other kinds of sectors.
Of course, it depends on where we're talking about, how they,
sure.
what it looked like 50 years ago. Can I go back to China, though? You were going to say something, I think, that burned this question. Mayor's in office. Mayor has certain capacities, but neither capitalism nor the corporate power structure are entirely within the mayor's capacity to shape. How does the mayor get leverage? What can the mayor do?
Yeah, because typically when you're mayor, the national government is not to your liking either because of the personalities in the national government, the structural relationship with the national government, so you don't like that. You know, corporate tastes and investment tastes are not to your liking, you don't like that, so you're in a bad place. I always analogize it to, you know, you're sitting on a lonely country road and you're waiting for the coach. The coach is not coming. But you're the mayor, you've got to figure out a way to start walking. You can't just sit there and complain. Therein lies a dilemma. And what typically... I see mayors do is you try to bring in investment and then through regulation, through subsidies, and through other means, channel that investment to create, you know, what we call multiplier effects, inclusive effects. You know, way back in the day when I got out of graduate school, I worked in a place that was well known in the States called the Boston Redevelopment Authority, and I was assistant director there, and we had this new program called Linkage, where if you build one of these monstrous buildings over whatever the number was, I forget now, 100,000 square feet, $5 went to housing, $1 went to jobs. So there was a notion of linking this investment to positive social effects. And I think that we've seen a lot of that, and that's been good. But I think the real Olympics here, to really get an A-plus in this, you've got to answer the question, why has a kind of breadth and velocity in terms of recovery from each recession been slower? Why have fewer jobs been created? You've got to figure out a way to actually directly bring your city back. And I haven't done this, and I haven't seen a lot of it. Figure out a way to invest in your people, in your neighborhoods, in your city, in ways and economies that create small businesses, that create jobs. One of the greatest things Saskia said over the years that I've carried with me to this day is the notion of the informal economy. How do you embrace this informal economy? I've actually gone to mayors around the world and they say, oh, mayor, I got this great city. As soon as I can get rid of this market over here and clear it out, everything will be great. I'm going, oh, my God, I want to, you know.
Right, right. Yeah.
That's great. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
That's the power of your city.
So let me take the same question, Jose, in a way. You, in a way, hinted at this, right? You labeled it narcissism, but the architect is, to some extent, at the mercy of getting commissions. Somebody comes along and says, we're going to rebuild Atlantic Yards. That's a fantastic opportunity to build a building. You'd build a better building than that. The era when so much of what Saskia talks about has happened has been an era of starchitects and extraordinary buildings, which you either don't like or like as individual works of art. Where does the architect come in? Is the architect really the prisoner of this pursuit of commissions, or are there a variety of ways, possibly by working with mayors or with others, to break out of that?
I think we're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't.
I was afraid that was the answer.
But let me take it even to a larger scale, which has to do not only with architects or with the practice and discipline of architecture, but to the question of cities in general. So somewhere between the dissatisfaction of Detroit and the dissatisfaction of, let's say, Bloomberg's New York, somewhere in between the London of the Thatcher era in the 80s and the London of the Qataris, there's no room for actually an understanding of success. Or we are very hard to find the...
I think that's a really good point.
What we like about
DC pre-Tony Williams, DC after Tony Williams. Everybody talks to me like there was this golden age before I came. The city was a disaster.
Yeah, it was.
You know what I mean?
But they are always disasters. I mean, in a way, they're always disasters.
Right,
and
right.
I mean, I was going to ask Saskia whether the problems of urban capitalism, or like, let's say capitalism in cities, is actually fixed with more capitalism or with less capitalism. And I have a question. I do think that the answer is not as easy, even here at the LSE, it's not as easy as we tend to think.
Yeah.
One could argue that it is not the question of the $1 billion project, how many billion-dollar projects we have in the cities, but whether it is actually better to have 10 projects of 100 million than one of a billion, or 100 projects of 10 million rather than a billion.
Right.
So it's about the fragmentation of finance, which could produce a form of porosity, real, let's say, physical and financial, which goes back to Tony's question of linkage. The other question that I do have is whether we can decouple the discussion of this sort of a mega global trends with a question of equity, and if it's necessary to produce this sort of coupled critique of the form of city this is creating with the form of finance that's creating the city.
Well, those are two great questions. I would say on the first one, when I think about urbanity as opposed to density, because the issue here is that we're producing a lot of density, but as I said, you know, de-urbanizing actually. So it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't have to be that way. But I think at the heart of the city, and the city means the neighborhoods, but within each neighborhood there is something that has to do with commerce and the civic. You know, when I think of old Baghdad, not that I was there when I think, I don't remember, but you know, old Jerusalem. This was amazing, so many different religious groups, but when it was in the bazaar, I mean, they may have had disagreements, but it was about commercial issues, you know? So the city has this capacity to intermediate all kinds of things in a good way. When I see these mega projects that occupy a lot of urban space, that eliminate urban tissue, little street, little this, little government office where that old little lady or this young student goes to get that, you know, eliminate. That to me is deeply problematic. You know, that really deconstructs. Cities have always undergone destructions. So the fact of destroying is not the issue. The issue is destroying a certain kind of tissue, you know, that is messy and implanting these monsters. If there are beautiful public architecture buildings, maybe you need some of that, right? You need some of that because it's sort of, you know. But do we need what is happening here? I'm not so sure. So that when the Chinese buy all these old buildings that are protected, you know, I really don't care who owns them, to tell you the truth. The buildings, it's still the built environment. But when I see this inserting of these huge mega projects, you know, that I find of concern. There was a second question that you asked, but I think
I wanted to come back. So you said it doesn't have to be this way. And I want to ask, well, why is it this way then? And to get beyond the, here's a pattern. I don't hear Jose or Tony sort of saying, oh, we like this. You're wrong to think terrible and monstrous. But why? Do we have to have such an extraordinary global transformation? They say, right, well, after we've gotten rid of global capitalism, this can be different. After we don't have an internationally linked financial system, this can be different. When we no longer have nation-state structures, this can be different. Is there something a bit more at the scale and the political organization of cities that could make this different?
Examples? The counter-argument, the positive to this, in experiences around the world, and certainly in my experiences, there are all the downsides to all this investment. On the other side, just in my city, all the investment we were able to bring in, we were able to accrete $1.5 billion for school construction. That's a good. That's a public good.
Yeah, investment is okay.
Right.
Absolutely. And so I always say, same thing with finance, frankly. Hey, they can make capital at a scale that is unbelievable. Well, let's materialize it and use it for something good, you know, social housing, green transport system. So it also depends how capital gets deployed. I find this a deplorable deployment. I'm just playing now with the language here. Of all that capital. And we know that there are piles of, including cash as opposed to derivatives based on interest, sitting there on the top that you don't know what to do with, right? So when you make the list of all that needs to be done, wow, could we, couple it?
Who's the we? Who can do it?
Politicians, citizens, activists, many people don't even know about this stuff, which is already disturbing, right? And this is just a part of the city, mind you. London still has a lot of neighborhoods, but we know from the neighborhoods that many people are feeling pressure, displaced, they are, gentrifying, et cetera, of a sort that is not so good. So I think it is sort of a problematic time. Now, I just am looking at major cities. You know, for all I know, most cities are not the cities that I talked about. Most cities are probably far more reasonable. It is amazing when you see how it is penetrating, into more and more places, this type of investment. But the truth of the matter is that this is an extreme condition. The question is it also sort of, as we might say as academics, heuristic? Does it tell us a story about a larger emergent history? Or is it just the thing in itself? I don't have an answer to that.
Well, in these cities, I think it is a story of, I'm talking about the gaps again, the local hard by, the global right smack together.
Yeah. So these can be one possibility is there's a set of global cities within which there's a massive circulation of foreign investment and capital markets are creating the particular problems we see in London and versions of them in a couple dozen other cities. I wanted to go to Jose and sort of say, well, how does this sound, if you think about Mexico City, is this something that is also coming? There's lots of porosity. There's lots of fine-grained, small-scale development. Mexico City hasn't been transformed completely in this way. It's not all good news. Does it feel like this is coming in as potential, or does it feel like there's a different story for Mexico City and a number of other major cities in the world that aren't quite the foreign capital market targets?
I would say that, contrary to what Saskia just said, that this is just kind of an extreme situation.
Yeah.
There's an irony that toxic ideas actually do have a trickle-down effect.
Yeah, I know. I was afraid of that.
And they do. I mean, they're doing and replicating these techniques in Latin America, in Africa, and in Southeast Asia as we speak. So it's not only, let's say, we have the Champions League, but even at the lowest level of a local football league, right, Someone's actually biting someone's ears, like Luis Suarez is. or trying to emulate Messi or Ronaldo. So I do think that
I didn't know this part of you. Are you really so much into
football?
Me too.
But if you're not into soccer, I think
I grew up in Argentina. I played soccer.
Argentina
I actually played soccer.
Netherlands and Argentina. If you don't like soccer, I think this is an absolute.
Right. There But now let's go back to
But this world of emulation, you're talking about sort of following the examples of others is big.
Yes. It goes back to the question of that Tony was touching upon, which is the trade-offs. We're always, as architects or as urban managers or as politicians, trying to understand where's the trade-off for forms of investments or forms of capital accumulation. So think of, for example, large infrastructure projects in Mexico. So we all agree that we need a better bus transport network.
Right.
And we need better intermodality hubs.
And the other thing I would mention too, and because I deal with this a lot, is of this class of the global investors, this isn't all just one big villainous class of people, and I'm not their spokesman, but for example, in the United States, we deal a lot on a project with what they call the givers. These are people of enormous wealth. They basically all pledge to give all their money back to society in one means or another, which is worthy of praise. And they're all interested in doing projects that are not self-interested but are about the public good. So I think part of leading a city is leading a community and finding out who these individuals are and trying to galvanize and harness that force for public good and for social responsibility.
I want to come back to what you said at some point, and that is that, you know, we need capital concentrations to say the United States, we have, 15,000 bridges or whatever that we know will fall down.
Yeah.
Every month one falls down, somebody loses a leg, another loses his life, you know, and we go on. But, you know, there is no money. This is the obscene part of it. No, exactly, but that's what I mean. It's an irony. There's a lot of money. Secondly, what I showed you, a lot of the stuff is empty. It's a holding operation. The city is paying, the larger community, if you want, is paying a price for that. But, you know, those who are putting, that's just a, when all is said and done, not a particularly huge investment for many of those investors. And a lot of those properties simply are underutilized. So when I put those two things together, you know, this is, you asked something, Craig, before about a deeper logic or whatever language you used, you know, something that underlies.
That sounds more like you than me, but okay.
Yeah, I know. but you know, there is a profound misalignment, and that is part of the issue. Right. If one would have access, you know, to these people who have all this money, and one would say, "This needs to be done. This needs to be done. This needs to be done." I'm sure that some of them would, actually, but some of them
so
not.
So one possible solution we can hope is that you get to sit next to a lot more really rich people, and give them advice. That's a non-systemic solution,
that's
right?
Not I mean, for
and
me.
And so we have various kinds of sort of solutions, that finance capital can behave differently, and how does that come about? That governments could be less out of balance with finance capital. Another way of looking at your story of 50 years ago and today isn't that there was no finance capital, it's the balance between the capacities of government, the capacities of finance capital wasn't as one-sided.
It was less finance capital.
It was less. There was, in fact, yes. I'm just in case I'm wondering, yes. Finance capital has gone from about 25 to about 75% of total assets. So there's a massive growth.
Yeah, massive.
But the same period is also the period of neoliberalism and a shift in government. Mm-hmm. And then there's a rise of philanthropy, partly as a byproduct of global inequality and the existence of large fortunes. So what are the places of access here in this world of philanthropy? There are governments. The governments haven't gone away, but they don't seem to be effectively acting to counteract the trends that you're looking at.
Yeah.
If anything, they are facilitating, right? They're on the package. And I think one of the things Tony said was a mayor can't decide he doesn't want investment.
Of course.
And so the mayor has to be in part a facilitator, can guide it, can try to steer it, can say, let's reserve 5% for this. Where's the point of traction on this?
I think there has to be more. I was so pleased to see Juan yesterday, the day before, talking about the importance of national policy and setting a strategy for a city, because there's so much conversation today about how the national strategy doesn't matter, cities can do all this on their own, which I think is preposterous. Yeah. Obviously, cities have to do a lot on their own. That can be necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient. The national policy is so important, and the mayors, the public managers, along with public-spirited people like this, have to figure out ways to network, to force those conversations, create those public policies. You know, so much of your job as a leader is as an educator. I've read so many books now about the Great Recession, and all these guys writing these memoirs and gals are all saying, oh, I wish I had done a better job educating the people about what needed to be done. It's nice for you to say now, right? So much of this is education. So I'll give you a great example is we had to rebuild our police department. One of the things we had to do when our police department was completely dismantled, not nominally, but certainly practically, we had to rebuild it. The good thing about that is we were able to build into the new department better citizen-police relationships. You see so much of this around the world, certainly now in the States now, most recently in Chicago, right, where race continues to be a big, big part, unfortunately, of this conversation, this cleavage that's used yep. to drive people yep. to act and vote against their own interests, I would argue, in my humble opinion.
Well, so if it's race in some places, be, yeah. it's nationality and immigrants in other places, but there are a series of these cleavages that undercut the possibility.
There's always somebody to beat up in every country.
Well, and there's always a challenge of building the coalition that can actually have power. Right. Oh, the people could have power, but the right. people are split and all this right. is happening. I think this is key. Let me ask a related question. I mean, Tony gave us the example of, and Saskia has on many occasions given the example of the vitality of the informal sector. What about the issues of corruption, tax avoidance, illicit capitalism? The informal sector, not at the small and creative level, the informal sector at the giant, massive flows of capital right. level.
But then we give it a different name.
Call it
entrepreneurial.
It's not completely different because the logic of tax avoidance links them. The money that is not there for city or national governments to spend because it's not being collected in taxes is a significant issue in a lot of places. And I agree that the illicit capitalism on the $1 trillion scale is different from illicit capitalism on the $20 scale. But I don't want to ask, I start with Jose in this. Where does corruption and where does this illicit, the capacity to carry out capitalism in illicit, untaxed form come into these stories?
I'll start by saying that in Spanish we have no translation for two words, which are accountability and enforcement. Huh. So basically, the system, and it's not a minor issue when we are not able. It goes back to our notion of naming things. It's not contabilidad. Contabilidad is
accounting. Yes,
the notion of being responsible. And transparency, just because it's an easier word in a way, but the moment that we don't have accountability to address the public for how the money is getting spent, who's getting the contracts, right. it's very difficult to actually right. follow a smoking gun. So this is probably is an inheritance from the Spanish colonial system. But I would say that it still permeates the way that city politics gets managed in our city. A recent study by the Mexican Institute for Competitiveness found out that, for example, the new airport that Sir Norman Foster is probably going to mention tomorrow.
Yeah, the odds are.
Don't laugh. It's not a. Don't laugh yet. Or don't call security, but 98% of those contracts had been direct commissions to construction companies. This means that the level, first of all, maybe we're not getting the best tenders, maybe we're not getting the best ideas, maybe we're not getting the best of what needs to be the best. And I'm not here to question Sir Norman Foster. I'm saying that maybe the guy who has a $1 billion contract to move land is clearly not accountable to the public in a question like this. And this is a major strategic infrastructure project. Yeah. When you think of the kind of the multiple scales in which this happens, this becomes a huge obstacle for growth.
I would say there are a couple things. One is I think we shouldn't, if we talk about other countries and corruption, I think the first thing we shouldn't be trying to do is just from the get-go trying to change their form of government and their culture and history, because you know things are what they are. That's number one. Number two, just in terms of corruption, I mean, in the history of many countries, there's been corruption, but at least the ill-gotten gains, so to speak, were reinvested in the country. So at least take the stolen money and reinvest it in the country.
Right. Right. Don't use it to buy property in London or Hong Kong.
Thank you.
That's right. Well, there were limited options where you were going to put your money.
And, but, you know, I'll just say a final thing. In education, so much, you see so many political leaders who've been corrupt, who are so powerful in their own communities, because so much of corruption is seen as Robin Hood and stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, and this is our hero. No, the guy was corrupt. How do you educate people to understand that and change the culture?
I must say, for me, the main objection I have to the current landscape are corporations who are not criminal, who are not bandits. Last evening, I happened to be at DigiComm, where we had a plenary debate with Google, and I raised the issue.
Now they're going to call security.
Now they'll call security. I raised the issue of taxation. And, of course, the head of Google is very smooth. And he said, well, we are waiting for the government to make new law, so otherwise we don't want to do it alone. Right. In other words, pay the taxes, you know, where they earn the money. And so when you look at, I mean, I did this for my expulsions book. I really looked at all kinds of accountants' analyses of this kind of corruption, you know, of the taxation issue for big corporations. And we all know about inversion, right? The debate right now with Pfizer, where an American company stays, you know, headquartered where it is, but it gives itself another nationality, so to say. And they use the language of inversion. I mean, you would say, inversion, how chic. I want to invert too. But, you know, this or quantitative easing, or, you know, the kind of, this is a language that obscures a kind of highway robbery that is at the heart of this system. But the amount of money that, well, if you take the United States government, you know, where corporate taxes used to be about 45%.
I think there were 70 officially under Eisenhower.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not even going far that back. But, you know, and now it's like 25%. That is for me a far deeper kind of corrosion, corruption, and criminality than the, you know, than some of the guys that you were alluding to, who are, of course, little criminals and all of that. I mean, I really think we have a serious issue, and I think the political classes are a bit out to lunch. They have decided that telecommunications is too complicated, we delegate to the experts. Who are they? The corporations. Finance, far too difficult. Whom do we delegate? To the financial system. No. So we have a serious problem, and I think you alluded to that, that the political system. Now, I, as I said about something else before, but now I want to say for no formal political system, type of political system, I'm talking about a format, has lasted forever. Why should this one? We might be seeing the decay of what at one point was a working liberal state. Now, that doesn't mean that communism is the option. I'm not saying that at all, because that is not an option either, I think. But I think that the way we're going, we're in trouble. There are very few governments that one can stand back and say, well, they are really accomplishing an agenda.
But at least in ancient Egypt, there was a mayor, so I can go to bed at night.
Right.
Saskia, one last question for all three of you. I'll start with Saskia.
There were also some architects, Tony.
Egypt did indeed have, some architects.
All right, we're not going to Tahrir Square now. But in this, I think, it's compelling. I agree with this. But let me, put it. So is one of the issues that liberal democracy has gotten stuck, and it turns out that democratic decision-making, which I think we mostly sort of believe in and desire, in the form in which it's been institutionalized, one person, one vote, large scale, the separation of economic wealth to be able to influence it, whatever. Is it that the liberal democratic systems are stuck? U.S. looks pretty much stuck on some of these issues. Yeah. And that it's the states that are effective in being able to bring power to bear on some of these questions, if they want to, are not very democratic. Whatever their choices in urban design, it's Singapore, or it's China, or it's a range of other rather more authoritarian states that are actually able to take hold of some of these problems. What does that say if it's
yes,
true?
Yes, of course, the landscape that you depict and the way you depict it is very difficult to disagree with what you're suggesting. The question for me is democracy. We, the citizens, our capacity to vote, has that really become an absolutely decaying instrumentality, you know, that we vote, but we have few choices. We vote for a government that then does anyhow. So I think that there is a real sort of, I see a decay of liberal democracy. And that doesn't mean that there aren't good alternatives that include democratic elements, but in a way I'm saying, you know, like who owns the state? My state, who owns it? I don't feel that the citizens, your average citizens, has. No, the state is some strange. So,
which state were you referring to when you said your state? By the way,
I'm especially thinking about that one. You know
yeah,
what
okay.
I mean.
The one I also
I mean,
have
very,
connections to.
Very, and I'm a supporter of our president, but still, you know, it's. And then when you bring in another element that I would like to just put on the table, which is that when this global era begins and deregulation and privatization become key issues, we hollow out the legislatures and the parliaments.
Yeah.
Because you you just shift functions. The functions don't disappear, but they become private specialized services, or they go into the executive branch of government. So we have, and the legislative is where we, the citizens, have our strong standing. We really do not have strong standing.
But my political mentor, professor, a guy named Stan Greenberg, who was a lot of Gerhard Schroeder, you know, Tony Blair,
right,
Bill Clinton, my professor, just wrote a book, and he was my poster too, but you never
yes.
know it. But anyway, so he wrote a book, just came out a couple weeks ago, called, I forget what, The Blue America or something, and it's about the march of the demographics. This is just one example in the States where essentially folks on the right side are in a rear guard action trying to hold back the tide. And so I'm a little more positive
okay.
over what's going to happen over the next 15 years than others.
Well, since we're talking about citizen power and democracy,
yeah.
I think we'd better go to the audience
for
questions.
It's about time, right.
And let me invite maybe five, invite questions. I'll call maybe five people, get questions, and then invite the panel to respond as they choose among these.
Yeah.
So there's a woman with her hand up, one seat in from the aisle, about 20 rows up there. Can you get the microphone to her?
Hello. Thank you for the presentation. It's highly insightful. My question is to Saskia Sassen. I'm interested to know a bit more about what we're likely to find in other cities, so not in the 100, and whether this kind of property investment is creating or likely to create similar levels of expulsions and spur the de-urbanizing that you spoke of.
Okay, great. Let's have another question here. I'm sort of in the front on this side.
Thanks. I'd like to ask about urban regeneration, which I suppose to highlight that's led or facilitated by public authorities and supported by designers. Now, for a long time, large-scale clearance and reconstruction was about kind of moral reform. For a while, it was about health. I guess I'm talking about 19th and 20th centuries, talking about the pathology. Could I ask what or whom does the current wave of urban regeneration serve?
Okay, urban regeneration. Another question. Okay, I've got one over here in the front.
Thank you very much for your talk. I think the solution could be very simple.
Oh, a simple solution. Let's
simple,
hear
it.
Simple
and beautiful. That the people of the city or country should own their land. And that means any profit that ever happens on that, or any business, or any living, or any investment would be owned by the people of that city or country. And this would stop all corruption and remove the royal family from their power base.
And the Duke.
And okay. The capitalist. And
I note that he described this as simple.
And Oxbridge. The people own the land. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Another question? Okay, right here.
Yes, hi. To pick up on the end of the discussion, I'm hoping you can discuss how you see participatory mechanisms for policymaking, agenda setting, decision making fitting into this conversation, and if so, what those look like.
Okay, and last question is the man in the about middle on the far right there. Wait for the microphone so everybody can hear you.
You talked earlier about the lack of definition of success and sort of taking out areas of cities that are deemed successful to redevelop them into huge tower blocks or whatever. Is our definition of value too narrow? And if so, how can we motivate the people in those positions to look at value beyond something that just fits in an Excel spreadsheet?
Okay, I hope you all took notes and know what you want to answer. Saskia, should we go in the same order we started?
Okay. So the first question, well, he already mentioned something about this. Investment is also beginning to happen. This kind of corporate buying of property or of urban land is also beginning to happen in what we might think of as smaller cities. In my list of 100 are quite a few. I don't want to call them smaller cities, but not the kinds of cities that we think of. For instance, Manchester and Birmingham in the UK are really receiving a lot of capital, not Liverpool, you know, which I find interesting also. And when you look at China, there are a lot of cities that we have never heard of. They are not small cities, but they are not particularly on international circuits where you also have capital coming in. Now, that might mostly be Chinese. You know, there is a lot of Chinese, what we might call corporate in quotation marks. Supposedly it's different, but it is that too. So I think that probably this is going to spread. And the list of 100 has a lot of smaller cities that would take you by surprise. You know? Now, the second question, your question, I would like to leave that to is that a good idea? Regeneration and, right? The owning of the land, you know, I think that if cities were corporations, a kind of, in the good sense of corporation, like the old-fashioned medieval term almost, that might be very interesting. My concern here is, I alluded to it in passing, is that the law is very ambiguous in many cities. It's like as if nobody thought about it. And so what's happening with this is one of my key concerns, actually, that I didn't develop here. What is happening with these big acquisitions, the contracts are done by very, very smart people, you can imagine. And I'm afraid that once this question of who owns urban land, you know, comes really back into the picture, that those contracts are going to provide some, you know, if you want antecedents, or, you know, this is what we have done and built, it will be built into what might be an urban law. There is quite a bit of discussion among legal scholars now in different parts of the world. They're a little group, but still they exist, about the question of urban, you know, law that addresses the question of urban land. This is something that had been totally out of the picture for 100 years or something like that, as far as I can tell, but it's now reemerging. Now, it's a very specialized little circuit, but they are in many different places of the world. So anyhow, that is an issue. Why don't you start answering the regeneration?
Because we have to be really quick. I'll try to connect the question of value regeneration and the question of land. Maybe we need to re-edit Henry George's 19th century books on the discussion of land economics. And our good friend Enrique Peñalosa, member of the
Urban Age,
and an expert in losing elections until 2 weeks ago, used to say that...
But he won, huh? He won this time.
Yes, he's back.
Now he's 2-7.
Is that really?
Yeah. But we're really happy for him.
Very happy.
He does better when he runs for mayor than president.
For 9 years, he told us that urban land cannot be managed as a kind of a capitalistic asset, so that states and cities should control that asset and manage it with in order to capture value in a different way. Let's see how that plays out in Bogota. But I think the question of value is really key, and it's actually connected to the notion of urban regeneration, because value is seen as an excuse to transform cities. Terms that used to be relevant at one point, think of urban renewal in the 50s and 60s, became toxic a few years after. Or even 9 years ago, Rem Koolhaas, talking in the second Urban Age conference in New York City, made a comment that the word gentrification, which we used to be critical, maybe in 2007 we were not so critical, right through the middle of the Bloomberg years. So I like to expand the question of value beyond a notion of economic wealth. Let me give you an example. In Berlin, 80% of the homes, of the households, are rentals. So how do you accumulate? I mean, everyone would probably agree that Berlin is actually a fairly attractive, cosmopolitan, interesting city. Poor but sexy, but we can argue whether that still holds true. But the question of ownership is actually decoupled from the notion of success. In the case of Mexico City and some of the poorest neighborhoods in Mexico City, it's actually the inverse. So ownership is 80% and rentals are 20%. So how do we connect the production of urban transformations to a kind of wealth and accumulation, even if it's micro entrepreneur, the guy who has a 150 meter plot and produces a house that, as Aravena was saying, is not a car and decreases in value, but actually produces capital. If there was one thing that I found fascinating, that Alejandro was apologizing for quoting Hernando de Soto, but if there was one thing that that de Soto did successfully for Latin America, is to connect the notion of houses and land can become a form of capital. Yeah. Whether we want to follow that absolute correlation, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So we have to be suspect of urban regeneration. I like to think of Brian Eno's oblique strategy of making more mistakes faster. In cities, if we produce smaller mistakes, we're more able to transform and learn from them, rather than if we do the $10 billion mistake, which takes a lot of time to retrofit.
So again, the same fragmentation, smaller scale experimentation.
Right. The way I would relate the questions, one with at the end, the question about joint ownership, I think I think we ought to keep trying, because we have tried. I've been involved with projects where we had common ownership, joint ownership of the project. Right. But the question was, how do you, within joint ownership, create incentives for everyone to take, so you don't have the tragedy of the common issue, right, where people are, transferring the burden to somebody else. But we ought to keep trying. As to the value of communities and value of property in an urban area, I think the common way of looking at regeneration has been to, again, look at you guys as subjects. We're going to do this for you. We're going to do this despite of you, on behalf of you, but not really with you. So we haven't figured out a way to regenerate an area. You continue to live in the area. We provide you jobs. We give you the education. We do all these things, and we bring the area back that way. Most folks in my business say, I'm just being honest, we say, oh, that's just too hard. Let's bring in the investment. We'll leave a few of you here, and we'll call that inclusive. Because that's why I call it the Olympics. It's really hard in the practical world to provide that uplift when the escalator is broken. What do I mean by the escalator? One of the ways that cities have functioned so well over the decades is people moved into the city. They were able to achieve upward mobility through jobs, and they moved on. The escalator kind of stuck, in the 60s? So you no longer have this upward movement, this job creation, this expansion of the economy.
The 60s were pretty good compared to
the look back to it now.
74, 75 recession.
This is where you get to the occupying, the whole notion of the occupying police force, because the only jobs that are left are with the government, and the folks in those jobs don't even live in the city, and therefore you get the conflict.
Can I make last word for you?
Just a final, and I'm going to take it into a totally different direction, but the current so-called migration crisis in Europe, where we deploy these two categories, immigrants, migrants, whatever, and refugees. And of course, they capture something. My question is, and it's an honest question, it's not a rhetorical question, is what am I seeing when I see these flows? Because there are also strategic flows, new types of flows happening from Central America, not Mexico, to the US, and then the Rohingya, you know, people. So we are very focused on Europe, but things are happening, new types of flows are emerging. Now, so my sense is that what we are seeing is the beginning of a new history. Mm-hmm. Now, in this moment, it's very acute, the war zones. You know, nothing competes with war in its immediacy of expulsion, etc. But when you look at the land grabs in the global south, when you look at the massive expansion of an extremely destructive type of mining, when you see that so many people are simply expelled from the countryside where they have inhabited, where they have knowledges about how to protect the earth, you know, make it have a long life, they all wind up flattened as urban slum dwellers, you know, all that knowledge, all those cultural issues. And so, for me, the dominant logic that is happening here, where war is indeed one element, but just one, is sort of this massive loss of habitat. Now, when I then come back to our cities and I see this, how can I not also ask, am I actually seeing the making in cities when you have this kind of appropriating of urban land and basically poorly inhabited, barely used? Are we also talking about a loss of habitat in our cities? You know, two very different worlds, by the way. But still, it seems to me that we need sort of new language to begin to capture some of these extreme conditions, whether it is the migration refugee crisis, whether it is this extreme buying up of ultimately pieces of urban land. This is not a happy note on which...
No, so we don't end on a happy note. We end with a question. We end with reasons for you to come back tomorrow night to hear Norman Foster talk about infrastructure.
Well, you will be very happy.
December 3rd to hear Richard Sennett talk about social equity in the city. Right now, please join me for thanking the Urban Age and our three panelists.
Urban Age.